Welcome, everybody. My name is Mark Schwain. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach at Valparaiso University. This is a session on war and peace. Last week, I had a couple of sessions on a book that was only 100 pages long. And this time, I'm going to have one session on a book that's 1,200. So I'm either going to have to talk very fast or take a different strategy. So I think I'm going to prefer the latter, take a different strategy here and talk about war and peace. Just out of curiosity, how many of you here have read War and Peace at one time or another?
Okay. It was so long ago.
About half of you. So then I'll just assume that this is, in a way, both addressed to those who may wish to undertake a kind of rereading, and to those who might want to know why they should do it for the first time. So in a way, I'll make this a kind of discussion going into some detail about the book, about why we should read a book like War and Peace. I think the short answer to why one reads a book like War and Peace is that here you have one of the greatest minds who's ever set pen to paper, who is dealing on a very broad canvas with fundamental matters of human concern and human life that have bedeviled and enthralled human beings throughout the centuries in a way that I think most readers agree is sometimes breathtakingly on target as far as being able to capture everything from what it's like to fall in love to what it's like to suffer terrible defeat to what it's like to be betrayed to what it's like to be in a bad marriage to what it's like to be in a good one to, I could go on and on. The point is that in a book of this magnitude and this scope and this depth, there is hardly anything that isn't at some point or another taken up there in a kind of unforgettable way. So one engages a classic because there's a kind of depth there of treatment and representation that often provokes in the reader a kind of shock of recognition. Tolstoy can put into words, and he does this repeatedly, certain nameless feelings that you have yourself had, but never been quite able to name or to put into words or to describe. And so, therefore, by reading this book, you often not only suffer a shock of recognition, but also come to understand not just the world, but also yourself better than you might have been able to do in any other way. So that's the kind of short answer. Nonetheless, there are some daunting features of this book that I think keep most people from picking it up and seriously engaging it, and that may be doubly daunting for those who've already read it, and I'm inviting them to pick it up again. I mean, for one thing, there is the length. It's the length of three solid novels. To be exact, it's about 1,200 pages long, and a nice hefty novel would be 300 pages, so you're looking at four big novels. So there is the length. There's also the fact that when you pick up the opening scene, it's set in a soiree in Petersburg, and everybody's speaking French. And the most recent translation, which I'm going to commend to you, has the French there. You read the English in footnotes, and you begin to think, I don't know about a social gathering in Petersburg with people who speak French and are talking about things I don't quite understand. I think I'll move on to something else. So that there are some things daunting when you first pick the book up. And trust me, that first scene is atypical. There are some other French phrases in the book, but they're all concentrated for the most part in that first scene in Petersburg. So there's that initial impression that puts some people off. Not only is the book huge in terms of pages, but of course huge in terms of characters and action. And this bothered critics at the time and ever since. Henry James, who was almost as good a literary critic as he was a novelist, referred to this famously as a kind of loose, baggy monster. And by monster, of course, he was referring to its enormous size. And by loose and baggy, he meant that it didn't really seem to him, Henry James, to have a kind of tight artistic structure, a discernible plot, or a discernible theme. It just seemed to be Tolstoy pouring himself out about a number of wonderful issues and developing a lot of wonderful characters, but that these never really hung together in any artistic shape. And James was par excellence the person who was interested in artistic shape, and he and some of Tolstoy's fellow countrymen, like Turgenev, complained right away that Tolstoy was, to be sure, a genius, and no one had ever written better, but he just didn't have a sense of structure and overall shape, and so you got this loose, baggy monster. So, according to some readers, not only is it big, but it's kind of shapeless, and that makes it doubly difficult to get through it because you lose your way, etc. Now, I think those critics were wrong. I think most critics today would say those earlier critics were wrong, and I'll say a little bit about how to navigate through that and what I think the shape of the book is in a minute. But I just mentioned these as some of the things that have put people off. One thing, by the way, that hasn't. There are much more difficult novelists to read in terms of their style. I mean, Faulkner in Stream of Consciousness writing and some of his novels, much more difficult than Tolstoy. There are many novelists who are much more difficult. Tolstoy's style and translation, especially this recent one, is very readily accessible, very fluent, very engaging, very easy to read. So that's not a reason not to read War and Peace or to be daunted by the book. So here are some just basic practical suggestions for how to navigate the book before we get into the substance. First, I highly recommend, and the bookstore has, this is a hardback version, which I had to take in a separate suitcase. the ones up at the bookstore are the soft cover editions, paperback, I mean. And it's the most recent translation, and it has gotten very, very high praise by all of the people who have studied Tolstoy in translation. I myself don't read Russian, so I can't say that I'm giving it my personal imprimatur, but I can say I've read lots of essays about this couple, Richard Pevere and Larissa Volokonsky, who live in Paris together and who have translated now all of Dostoevsky, all of Tolstoy, most of Gogol, most of Chekhov. They're just a fantastic couple. And this translation, I mean, I've taught the book in three translations, I can just tell you, is just much more riveting to me, to the students, and so I think it, judging by my experience, deserves every bit of praise it has. Normally, I don't encourage my students to lean on critical apparatus of one kind or another, but here I think that they have wonderful stuff in here that you can use to keep your bearings, and I would encourage you to do that. They have at the end a plot summary, part by part, book by book, volume by volume. And I'm not telling you to read the plot summary and say, well, now I'm done with that. I'm saying to you that one thing with a big book like this is that you tend to put it down for a half a day, and return to it after two or three, and you want to get your bearings, and the plot summary just does that. You kind of go back, and you can go over very quickly the territory that you've covered and get reoriented to where you are in the book. So that's extremely handy to have. There's a nice early list of characters by family groupings, and that's very handy to have. There's a whole historical glossary there of names, so when you find a reference you don't know, it'll be in here. And there are some footnotes that refer to the superscript notations in the text that you can refer to that just explain more about a particular character, reference, etc. So the book doesn't have an apparatus that's distracting. You don't have to go back every time there's a footnote. But I find especially the plot summary to be wonderful, and of course the list of characters and their introduction is well worth reading as well. So here with War and Peace, I'm recommending that you make full use of the critical apparatus. And I'm even going to recommend you do something that I almost never tell my students to do, and that is the BBC had in the early 70s this courage to set out a lavish expenditure to make a 20-part made-for-TV series on war and peace. It's available in this way, 5 different DVDs, 20 episodes, roughly 20 hours of viewing. And so I think it's really nice as you're reading to kind of follow it here as well. It helps you envision certain things. It was the place, by the way, that Anthony Hopkins came into stardom. He plays the leading, well, arguably the leading character in War and Peace, Pierre. And he's absolutely fabulous in this, quite stunning. And the battle scenes alone at places like Borodino and Austerlitz, sometimes filmed actually at the real scene of the battle, are really quite spectacular. So I would suggest that you use this maybe to supplement your reading, not to replace it. So I would read, I would use this, say you're finished with half the book and you want to kind of review other than reading the plot summary, this is very good. I've done it this way. I taught this last semester and my class came over twice, each for 10-hour marathons. I said they could come and go as they please. They didn't have to stay the whole time. We just began putting out chicken and other foodstuffs at about 5 in the evening, and by 12 or 1, almost all of them were still there, and we had to order extra chicken 3 times. As long as there's free food, the students seem to stay there no matter what you're showing. But they really appreciated this too as a kind of way, a different way of kind of reviewing the terrain that they had covered. And of course, they by that time could be very critical of the way in which the BBC had chosen to abbreviate, amend, and do the other things that you have to do to get this whole novel on film. I mean, 20 hours is a lot, but it by no means covers every detail of the book. So anyway, I think that your enjoyment will be enhanced if you use a volume, a translation like this, and if you use something like this to sort of supplement your reading. Otherwise, you'll lose your way, lose your bearings, and give up way too quickly. If you can take it up and persuade your reading group to do it, I know some of our alums in the Honors College where I teach have reading groups, and I know this is coming up as a recommendation that they take this up in their reading groups. The college kind of recommends what they might take up and provides some study guides. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but I think reading groups really help, where you kind of are kept on task by your meetings and you have a chance to discuss different segments of the book. So all of those things I would highly recommend your doing. Now, let me just say a little bit about the shape of the book and take up some of those criticisms I mentioned earlier to the effect that this was just a loose, baggy monster with no artistic shape. I think Tolstoy has a very definite design to this book, a very definite plot, and probably, however, 5 central characters in an ensemble instead of 1 central character. Okay? So I think part of the reason people are baffled is they're looking for who's the protagonist, and it's just not that clear who the protagonist is until you really begin to see Tolstoy's overall design, which has to do with these 5 people and their multifarious interactions with each other over the course of a long period of time, roughly 15 years, during the entire period when of the Napoleonic Wars and then beyond. There's a kind of epilogue that takes them up in sort of middle age. And if you think of the 5 main characters as the central character, and you look at 2 different dimensions of the book, you'll have a sense of very definite artistic shape. One of those dimensions is simply the huge movement, first from west to east, as the Napoleonic armies and the Allies steadily move toward Russia, and then the Russian border, and then into Russia, and then into Moscow. And then, of course, the reverse movement, when that same army moves back and is repelled and moves back from east to west. So there's this huge movement of millions of people, not just the great armies, but also all of the people who were displaced, etc. This huge background of events that are collectively enormous upheaval, against which background the lives of these five principal characters and a whole host of minor characters lead out their lives and realize their destinies. The book has a very discernible plot shape. All five of those characters are introduced very quickly. There's a kind of falling action first. Each one of the five of them undergoes different reversals, different difficulties, faces, often unsuccessfully, certain challenges, and by the end of the first half of the book, each and every one of them is, in some sense or another, at their nadir. And then the second part of the book begins, just as Napoleon is ready to enter Russia, and we see these people now as the French armies move in to the country and ultimately occupy Moscow. We see each of them, in a sense, come into their own. Each of them enjoys a kind of rising action. Each of them that you have come to know and often to love in the first half, as they've been often undone by different adversities, really comes into their own and surprises and pleases and enthralls you in any number of ways. So it seems to me that this falling action and this rising action and five characters and some other structural things I talk about in a moment give the book a very definite and wonderful shape. I should admit that a dimension of the book that also puts people off, Tolstoy will often go into large digressions, especially in connection with the battle scenes, in which he talks about his own view of history. And his own view of history has to do with what he finally thinks it is that could have caused hundreds of thousands of people to move all this way from west to east, and then to turn around and move back from east to west, and to slaughter one another, etc., etc. So there's a lot of his writing in the book itself and in the famous epilogues about the philosophy of history, and some people find that kind of dry. I think that you should make your way through it, because oftentimes this will be very well dramatized in the action of the book. A few of his cardinal views of what makes history work and what makes it move. And that's another thing that adds texture to the book. Of course, another main shape of the book is suggested by its title, War and Peace. One constantly is moving back and forth from the scenes on the battlefield in these different military engagements, which I must say are stunningly realized. You would think, well, this is something that's gendered. Men might like it, women might not. Not so. I have found in teaching it that the ballroom scenes and the soirees seem to be enjoyed just as much by men as by women, and contrarywise, the battle scenes just as much by women as by men. Curiously, one of the movements of the book is the more you look at these two different domains that look very different at first, the battlefields and the drawing rooms, the more and more, in very important ways, they look very much alike. And he's very skillful at drawing those likenesses to your attention as the book proceeds. So that's another great structural principle of the book, the movement back and forth between scenes of warfare and scenes of peace. Scenes within the home or within society on the one hand, scenes on the battlefield and warfare on the other. Another great principle here to watch is that the book contains a kind of, I would call it a kind of moral geography around three basic locations, three basic places, each place of which has its own central family. There's Petersburg, which is the place that opens the book, where everybody's speaking French at the soiree, because that's what high-class, hoity-toity folks do who've been Europeanized and are trying to seem stylish. Tolstoy, of course, despises these people. But basically, Petersburg is dominated by a family called the Kuryagins. And one of the first people you meet is the patriarch of that family, Prince Vasily, who has three children, Anatole, Hippolyte, and Helene, or as they call her throughout the book, La Belle Helene. Very attractive, but very artificially made up woman. This family embodies all the values of Petersburg society, which has been utterly Europeanized, oftentimes in ways that have to do with a kind of moral corrosion. And so that would be at one extreme. If something takes place in Petersburg, even to some of the best characters, you can bet things are not going to work out very well. Just watch Petersburg as a kind of part of this moral geography. At the other extreme, we have Moscow. And here we have the Rostov family. And this family isn't by any means a kind of gallery of virtue. Count Ilya Rostov, the father, is a kind of prodigal guy, spends his fortune carelessly, can't ever say no to his children, spoils them shamelessly. Lots of things about him are not particularly admirable. And his wife, Countess Natalie, is equally a combination of virtue and vice. And they have these four lovely children, Vera, the oldest daughter, Nikolai, Natasha, and Petya. And I've underlined characters, by the way, these five, who are the central five characters in the book. So two of the five are Rostovs. So in between, then, Moscow, which is Mother Russia personified, and Petersburg, the sort of Europeanized major city, is the estate of the Bolkonsky family, Bald Hills. So now we have country in between these two metropolitan areas. And here the patriarch is Prince Nikolai, who has two children, Prince Andrei and Princess Maria, and they are two of the other five principal characters. Now, there are a lot of other servants and relatives and so forth and so on that are part of each of these family constellations, but another thing to watch in the book is this minuet that goes on throughout of the encounters between these various family members. And the families are wonderfully realized as having a kind of, at one and the same time, a kind of collective character. There's something very definitely Kuryagin about all the Kuryagins. But at the same time, the three are very different from each other. And the same with the Rostovs. I mean, Vera especially is very different from Natasha. And yet somehow all of them are very clearly Rostovs. Just as Bolkonsky's Andrei and Maria, as different as those two characters are, Maria, a deeply religious person, I think really subjected to an abusive relationship. Her father, I think, is clearly abusive to her, so she's very, for the first half of the book, I think obviously injured as a result of that abuse and very retiring, shy, almost completely lacking in self-esteem. Andrei is perhaps the most quote-unquote menschly character in the book by contrast, and yet as her fate goes down by the end of the first at the end of the first half of the book and she begins to rise in the second half, as I said, and come into her own, you really are astounded at how much, after all, she's really like Andrei and how much even she's like her father in very interesting ways. So another basic structural principle of the book is this moral geography. Bald Hills, the country, has some of the features of Moscow, some of the features of Petersburg, but really, I think, rather than just think of it as a kind of hybrid of the two, I think the best way to think about it is a kind of third center of moral and social energy all on its own. But that's another way, it seems to me, that Tolstoy has sort of beautifully structured the book, and another thing to really keep your eye on as you're reading it. Just a taste of the way Tolstoy swiftly characterizes Prince Vasily. This will give you a sense of how he swiftly characterizes an individual and also a kind of sense of the Kuryagin ethos. Prince Vasily did not think out his plans. Still less did he think of doing people harm in order to profit from it. He was simply a man of the world, who succeeded in the world and made a habit of that success. According to his circumstances and his intimacy with people, he constantly formed various plans and schemes, which he himself was not quite aware of, but which constituted all the interest of his life. He would have not one or two of these plans and schemes going, but dozens, of which some were only beginning to take shape for him, while others were coming to completion, and still others were abolished. He did not say for himself, for instance, quote, here is a man who is now in power. I must gain his trust and friendship, and through him arrange for myself the payment of a one-time subsidy, unquote. Nor did he say to himself, quote, here Pierre is rich. I must entice him to marry my daughter and borrow the 40,000 that I need from him, unquote. But let him meet a man in power, and in the same moment his instinct would tell him that the man might be useful, and Prince Vasily would become intimate with him, and at the first opportunity, without any preparation, instinctively would flatter him, behave familiarly with him, talk about what was needed, and they would soon be friends. So in other words, here's a man who is so instinctively and habitually manipulative that he doesn't even have to think out plans. It's just like a kind of a law of nature that he gravitates toward power and somebody who can do something for him in the same way that a moth instinctively gravitates toward flame. And his whole family constellation, really, instead of having a kind of natural spontaneity, which the Rostovs constantly do, has always a kind of calculating artificiality about them. So it's really a wonderfully orchestrated contrast between the Kuryagins and the Rostovs, with the Balkanskis sort of in between. Pierre is the one character that I've alluded to before. I mentioned that he's the character who is played by Anthony Hopkins. And he doesn't fit into any of these family constellations. If you had to pick a central character, which I don't think you should, he would have a large claim to that. And it's very important that he not be from a family. He is an illegitimate son of an aging Count Bezukhov, whose fortune he inherits early in the book. He's educated in Paris, making him suspect. He's been away from home for many years when we first meet him, being educated abroad. So he's without family, really, without Russian roots for the most part. And he is, for much of the book, a kind of amorphous, that is, a kind of formless person. Unlike any of these others, who have a very definite character, largely taken up by the kind of families they come from and the kind of locations or places they inhabit, Pierre is, in a way, placeless and familyless and hence without form or amorphous. This makes Pierre very interesting, partly because he has at base a very good and open heart. And this means that he, in our popular parlance today, we would say that Pierre is the ultimate seeker. Pierre is always seeking some system of meaning or truth that will begin to make sense for him of his life. And so he becomes taken up for a long portion of the book with becoming a mason. Because someone speaks to him about that as providing the kind of system that he can try. Of course, he eagerly embraces it, and when Pierre embraces anything, he embraces it wholeheartedly. So he becomes the star mason of Moscow for a time. Then he becomes disillusioned with that. Then he meets, toward the end of the book, this very wise peasant who's a co-prisoner of war with him, Platon Karatov and Karatev. And he becomes completely enamored by his view of life. So throughout the book, he becomes enamored of, and he fully inhabits different views of life. He's a real seeker. And it's interesting to see where and why he finally settles where he does. So he's very interesting to chart in that sense. Unlike these others, as I said, who are firmly rooted both in place and in family, he's not, and therefore he's open to anything. In fact, I mentioned his being a mason. one of the primary sources for people doing works on Masons, historians, was Tolstoy's War and Peace, because of course the Masons being a secret society, it was from time to time, or for a long time, very hard to get primary documents. And there's so much detail in here about the secret rituals of Masonry and what they actually do in their initiation rituals and so forth and so on, that people relied for many years, now there are better sources, on War and Peace to talk about that. So anyway, you have Pierre then you have two characters from this family constellation, two characters from this family constellation, and they together, as I say, are the five principal characters. Let me stop here. I have some more to share with you, but to see if there are any questions so far.
Doesn't it make a difference who's going to translate? Because this genius, Tolstoy, writes this wonderful book, but he's writing Russian, and then I assume that could be translated a variety of ways?
Sure. It does make a difference, as it does with, you know, our scriptures. It makes a very big difference who's translating. And as I said, I'm not an authority, because I don't read Russian, but I've had, in some of these essays on this translation, people line up different translations and compare them in commending this one, and you can really see a difference in capturing the vitality of the language while being deeply faithful to it. So I can just say that I think this one really makes Tolstoy read splendidly. Okay, let me then go on. I'm going to read you some passages, and then I'm going to show you a little scene so you can sample the DVD. What had all the critics from the very beginning quite captivated by Tolstoy, even the ones who thought it was a loose, baggy monster, was this repeated capacity to put into words, as I've said, certain states of being, certain feelings that all of us have at one time or another, and that many of us have known, but which we've never been quite able to verbalize, and suddenly Tolstoy puts them in the language and we think, well, that's it. So I thought I'd read you one here at the beginning, which he couldn't have known from firsthand experience, just to give you a sense of the scope of his imagination, because this is all about what it's like to be a mother, something that I'm quite sure Tolstoy was not. The background to this passage is that here we are now at the Rostov family, and Countess Natalie has been deeply distressed that poor Nikolai has been at the front, and she's gotten the letter that indicates that at Schongraben, which is part of the campaign in 1805 in Europe, with the Russian army allied with the Austrians, has been wounded. And she's distraught about this, but at the same time relieved that his wound hasn't been mortal. And she becomes very proud of him. And she has the letter, and now we're going to hear Tolstoy describe what she does with the letter and what she feels like as a mother. Nikolushka, that's a term of endearment, Nikolushka's letter was read 100 times. And those who were deemed worthy of listening to it had to come to the countess, who never let it out of her hands. Tutors, nannies, Matenka, some acquaintances came, and the countess reread the letter each time with new delight, and each time, through this letter, discovered new virtues in her Nikolushka. How strange, extraordinary, joyful it was that her son, the son who 20 years ago had moved his tiny limbs barely perceptibly inside her, that son over whom she had quarreled with the too indulgent count, that son who had first learned to say brush and then mama, that this son was now there in a foreign land, in a foreign surroundings, a manly warrior, alone, with no help or guidance, and doing there some manly business of his own. All the worldwide age-old experience, showing that children grow in an imperceptible way from the cradle to manhood, did not exist for the countess. her son's maturing had been at every point as extraordinary for her as if there had not been millions upon millions of men who had matured in just the same way. As it was hard to believe 20 years ago that the little being who lived somewhere under her heart would start crying and suck her breast and begin to talk, so now it was hard to believe that this same being could be the strong, brave man, an example to sons and people, that he was now, judging by this letter. Yeah. So the notion here is that at one level, of course, this woman knows that her son is growing up in much the same way that millions have, but at the level of her heart, she believes that every single moment of his own development was extraordinary and without precedent anywhere, and she continues to kind of marvel at it. And so he kind of puts into words something that's really not quite rational, and that probably no mother has ever thought in just those words, right? It's not like he's giving literal voice to thoughts mothers have had, but he's giving voice to certain feelings of what it's like to be a mother, in a way that captures them, I think. I'm not a mother myself, but it looks to me like he captures them very well. Another thing very different, and this I can vouch for, that he writes about, is what I call guy talk, okay? Guy talk is the tendency that young men have, and here we're going to hear Nikolai, to tell stories to other guys about their exploits, and this happens to be his exploit in battle. It could be your exploits on the basketball court. It could often be your exploits on your first or second or 16th date with someone. And these stories that men tell one another turn out to have a certain characteristic form to them. And Tolstoy's now going to capture that as Nikolai talks about his experience in battle. So here again, it seems to me, he's again capturing something universal. Here we go. Boris, noticing that Rostov, this is Nikolai now, was preparing to make fun of someone else, artfully diverted the conversation. He asked Rostov to tell them how and where he had received his wound. This pleased Rostov. He began telling the story, growing more and more animated as it went on. He told them about his Schoengraben action in just the way that those who take part in battles usually tell about them. That is, in the way they would like it to have been, the way they have heard others tell it, the way it could be told more beautifully, but not at all the way it had been. Rostov was a truthful young man. Not for anything would he have deliberately told an untruth. He began telling the story with the intention of telling it exactly as it had been, but imperceptibly, involuntarily, and inevitably for himself, he went over into untruth. If he had told the truth to these listeners, who, like himself, had already heard accounts of attacks numerous times and informed for themselves a definite notion of what an attack was and were expecting exactly the same sort of account, they either would not have believed him or, worse still, would have thought it was Rostov's own fault that what usually happens in stories of cavalry attacks had not happened with him. He could not simply tell them that they all set out at a trot, he fell off his horse, dislocated his arm, and ran into the woods as fast as he could to escape a Frenchman. Besides, in order to tell everything as it had been, one would have to make an effort with oneself so as to tell only what had been. To tell the truth is very difficult, and young men are rarely capable of it. So there you have it, seems to me, this extraordinary account of how he kind of means to tell the truth, but then kind of takes account of the audience and what they were really expecting, and he begins then, in spite of himself, to embellish it, and he embellishes it in a way that's according to kind of what they expect, and pretty soon he sounds like all the young men who would tell the same story, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, it seems to me, again, kind of a brilliant short sentence that captures something vitally important. suddenly you'll come upon funny passages. I'm going to read you one of the funny ones where Tolstoy suddenly summarizes in different sentences different national characters. One of Tolstoy's major historical theses here in this book is that the people who think, and Napoleon is the classic case, that they're in control, that they're in command of a situation, that it's their decisions that determines the outcome of history, are in fact the furthest from determining the outcome. The ordinary foot soldier has much more not only of a sense of battle, but a role in determining the outcome than the great Napoleon. So he turns the pyramid of causation on its head. The people who think that they are the planners and the movers and shakers are in fact the least effective in charting the course of history. The people who are at the base of the pyramid, the ordinary foot soldier, the ordinary citizen going about his or her daily life, these people have much more to do with the fate of Russia than do Kutuzov, their great general, or Napoleon, the great French commander. What Tolstoy makes most fun of are the Germans, because the Germans are convinced in planning battles that it's a science, and that if only you could reduce this to a systematic science of battle, which they believe that they have, and you impose that systematically on a situation, things will all work out. So they are the consummate planners, okay? And of course, constantly their plans completely go up in smoke with the first shot. They don't seem to realize this. They just think the plan wasn't developed as elaborately as it might have been. And in the next battle, they turn to develop even more elaborate strategic plans. So it's the context of this that now he has Prince Andrei, who is skeptical of all of this planning, listening in at a group of folks planning for a battle from all different nationalities. And here we come to this sentence here. Prince Andrei, owing to his memories of Austerlitz, formed a clear notion of Fool, who's a German general, Fool's character for himself. Fool, P-F-U-E-L, was one of those hopelessly, permanently, painfully self-assured men as only Germans can be, and precisely because only Germans can be self-assured on the basis of an abstract idea. Science, that is, an imaginary knowledge of the truth. A Frenchman is self-assured because he considers himself personally, in mind as well as body, irresistibly enchanting for men as well as women. An Englishman is self-assured on the grounds that he is a citizen of the best organized state in the world, and therefore, as an Englishman, he always knows what he must do and knows that everything he does as an Englishman is unquestionably good. An Italian is self-assured because he is excitable and easily forgets himself and others. A Russian is self-assured precisely because he does not know anything and does not want to know anything because he does not believe it possible to know anything fully. So there you have these different sort of summaries of these different national characters sitting around attempting to plan a battle and other things together, and these different traits are now boiled down into these little aphoristic sentences. Okay. What I thought I'd do is to show you just give you a flavor of the BBC, and then read you a little bit about what it's like to fall in love. This is one of the great set pieces of War and Peace that people recall over and over. It's the young Natasha coming out at her debutante ball. And I'll comment as we see the ball unfolding in Petersburg as to who's who. And then I'll read you some of the passages describing what it's like to fall in love for Prince Andrei. Thank you.
for Konstantin. May I introduce myself? I'm Mikhail Speransky.
Of course. I knew you at once. I've been wanting to meet you since I read your reforms to the government.
That's very kind. There's a great deal to do and too few people, frankly, want to do it. I've read your report of the suggested reforms of the army. I was so impressed.
Thank you. Very little seems to have happened to it.
Well, these things take time. There's a lot of opposition. I just wanted to say how glad I am of someone of your ability of involving himself in this way.
When I left the war,
as Prince Andrei,
reaction against public work, I became something of a recluse.
You were too young for that.
Well, you know, Austerlitz was an unforgivable disaster. It needn't have happened. It left me only with a desire to get away from it all. So I spent my time reorganizing my states.
Yes, I heard about it. You're among the first to introduce difference and liberate yourselves. I should be generally followed.
Oh, I think it would be, given time. There are economic advantages too, you know, that people are unaware of. It isn't all humanitarian, is it?
Well, I just wanted to say how glad I am to see you back in harness, as they say. We have the air of His Majesty, you know. This is a wonderful time we're working.
I understand that you're revising the legal code.
That is so. The commission has been in existence for 50 years and has done absolutely nothing. Do you have any ideas on this subject?
Only in those areas where it touches on the position of the aristocracy.
Excellent, excellent. Let's meet and talk about it. Do come and see me. I think we'll be of help to each other, and to Russia too. Well, and the ball, one must dance.
Pierre here in the center, Anthony Hopkins, and then on the left-hand side, La Belle Hélène, to whom he's married very unhappily. Hélène, remember, is the daughter of Prince Vasily, who's completely manipulated Pierre into that fateful marriage.
We need to come to arrive here.
Here we are at the Rostovs, and they're late for the ball because Natalie, Natasha, that Natasha there on the left, mother, is still fussing over her dress, and Sonia, who is to your right, who grows up in the Rostov household and who's a very close friend of Natasha's, they're all still fussing over what to wear, a not uncommon thing.
Just a minute, Barbara.
We're going to be dreadfully late.
No, we're not.
Well, we should have been there at 10 o'clock, and it's 10 o'clock now.
Yeah, that's done. Then that's better. That's much better.
The hand's done. The hand's
oh,
done.
Oh,
there.
Well, fix it. Don't crouch there, screeching.
Where's the little cotton?
Ready, you go.
Oh, almost ready, Papa. Don't come in yet.
There. How does that look?
Oh, lovely, Sonia. Oh, you look exquisite, doesn't she, Mother?
Yes, she does. Now, will you please be still? Now, do you want to get to the ball or not?
Yes, of course I do, my darling. Only do, honey.
Yes, but it's almost done.
Oh, good heavens, I'm so excited. Do you think the Tsar will really be there?
Well, of course he will. Said so on the invitation. The Tsar doesn't say he's going to a ball and then not go.
Oh, Natasha, do you think anyone will ask us to dance?
Of course they will.
I couldn't bear it if you were left standing all evening. There'll be so many beautiful women there.
But we'll be the best, won't we, Nana?
What a question. Of course you will.
Oh, haven't you finished yet?
Yes, please keep standing there. Your hair's down. Now, where's the car?
It's in the drawer. Oh, just a minute, Papa. Oh, Mavra, do hurry.
I am hurried. You'll have been all day all evening. If only Nikolai were here, he'd dance with us.
Oh, you'll have plenty to dance with. You don't worry.
Still, it would be nice to go in with a young man, especially a youth.
Yes, but Nikolai, he's such a terrible dancer.
He's not.
Oh, he is. He's so stiff. Now, when that Denisov were here, Sonia, do you remember him? What a good dancer he was.
The berserker, that's all he could do.
But how he could dance.
There. Now, let me see.
It's beautiful.
My little son, it doesn't she look lovely?
How's that? It's lovely, Olga. Is it strange?
Well, Captain Strick, how can I tell when you're bending over?
We're going to fast forward to get them to the ball here, otherwise they'll be dressing all night.
Like you, take solace in the living.
It's Pierre.
May I present my daughter, Natasha?
My niece, Fonny.
Prince André, and she finds him, and Pierre is the one who arranges to introduce the two of them. Here comes the Tsar, he parades around, and then Pierre arranges to get the two of them together after the Tsar marches around, and there he comes.
Oh, yes, I would.
Okay, I'm going to read you now a little section from there to tell you what André felt like when he was dancing with Natasha for the first time. André has been prone to a lot of malaise. He's been very disillusioned with his quest for glory in battle. And he comes to that discovery of the emptiness of glory and ambition when he's wounded at Austerlitz. And he has spent months at his estate. You heard that referred to at Bald Hills at the very beginning of this scene, trying to reform by freeing his serfs and establishing supportive institutions for them. But he's very jaded, very disillusioned, very cynical, very empty man. And he's only himself coming back into society when this happens. And here he runs into Natasha, whom he's heard sing in a scene before the ball, and has been stirred by her voice. But now when he asks her to dance, here is the way that Tolstoy described that scene. Prince André liked to dance, and wishing to rid himself quickly of the political and intellectual conversations with which everyone addressed him, and wishing to break quickly this vexatious circle of embarrassment caused by the presence of the sovereign, that is, the Tsar, had gone to dance and had asked Natasha because Pierre had pointed her out to him and because she was the first pretty woman his eyes fell on. But as soon as he put his arm around her slender, mobile, quivering waist, and she began to move so close to him and smile so close to him, the wine of her loveliness went to his head. He felt himself revived and rejuvenated when, catching his breath and leaving her, he stopped and began to look at the dancers. And then a few pages later, we get this extraordinary passage of Tolstoy describing André falling in love without André realizing that he himself is falling in love. Prince André sensed in Natasha the presence of a special world, completely foreign to him. Filled with joys of a sort as yet unknown to him, that foreign world which even then, in the Atradno Avenue, and at the window on the moonlit night, had enticed him so. Now that world no longer enticed him. It was no longer foreign, but he himself, having entered it, found in it a new delight. He's just had dinner now at the Rostovs following the dance, and after dinner, Natasha, at Prince André's request, went to the clavichord and began to sing. Prince André stood by the window, talking with the ladies, and listened to her. In the middle of a phrase, Prince André fell silent and suddenly felt choked with tears, which he did not know was possible for him. He looked at the singing Natasha, and something new and happy occurred in his soul. He was happy, but at the same time, he felt sad. He had decidedly nothing to weep about, but he was ready to weep. About what? His former love? The little princess, his wife who had died? His disappointments? His hopes for the future? Yes and no. The main thing he wanted to weep about was a sudden, vivid awareness of the terrible opposition between something infinitely great and indefinable that was in him, and something narrow and fleshy, fleshly, that he himself, and even she, was. This opposition tormented him and at the same time gladdened him while she sang. As soon as Natasha finished singing, she went over to him and asked him how he liked her voice. She asked it and became embarrassed just after she had said it, realizing it was not a question to be asked. He smiled, looking at her, and said that he liked her singing, just as he liked everything she did. Prince Andrei left the Rostovs late in the evening. He went to bed, as was his habit, but soon realized that he could not sleep. Lighting a candle, he would sit on the bed, then get up, then lie down again, not troubled in the least by his insomnia. He felt as joyful and new in his soul as if he had gone from a stuffy room into God's open world. It did not occur to him that he was in love with Miss Rostov. He was not thinking of her. He only pictured her to himself, and owing to that, his whole life appeared to him in a new light. Why do I thrash about? Why do I fuss inside this narrow, limited frame when life, the whole of life with its joys, is open to me, he said to himself. And for the first time in a long while, he began making happy plans for the future. He decided that he must occupy himself with the education of his son by finding a tutor for him and entrusting the boy to the tutor. Then he must retire from the service and go abroad to see England, Switzerland, and Italy. I must use my freedom while I feel so much youth and strength in me, he said to himself. Pierre was right when he said, one must believe in the possibility of happiness in order to be happy, and now I suddenly believe in it. Let the dead bury their dead, but while I'm alive, I must live and be happy, he thought. Okay, so this is a description of a guy falling in love without knowing he's falling in love. And Tolstoy can give you that kind of view of matters in this very memorable way, even as his central character, Andre, has yet to figure things out for himself. Well, that just gives you a kind of sample of some of the great treasures that kind of await you there that will kind of leap off the page, and you'll think, well, this was worth the last 200 pages, just this particular just this particular scene, just this particular insight, or he's named what I felt myself back then on this, or what I feel now but couldn't name, and so forth and so on. You just repeatedly have that kind of wonderful feeling when you read Tolstoy. So that's my final recommendation. I have time for a couple of minutes worth of questions, I think, before 7:15.
Is this still being assigned in English classes, high school?
Well, it was assigned in mine. I can vouch for that. I taught a whole semester just on that book and one other that I had the students read with it. Actually, it was Aristotle's Ethics, because I wanted them to have a chance to study character closely. And this is a book where you get to see characters. Natasha's 13 when the first scene opens. By the time there, she's 18 at the ball. And she's 26 in the epilogue. So you get to see this 13 years of her life. So you really get to see these five very interesting characters and others besides not only grow through a long period of time, but against this great background of upheaval. So you can really look at character in different contexts very deeply and thoroughly in a way that you rarely can in any other book. I mean, what other book is of this length and magnitude?
But not in high school, so I'd say no.
No, not in high school, right. Too long, right? But it is assigned in college, though. I mean, there'll be courses in Russian literature when you read either that or Anna Karenina. And then one or two big Dostoevsky, some Turgenev, etc. That would not be atypical.
Okay, thanks very much.